Good afternoon. Please be seated. The next case on the court's argument docket today is Michael Schofield v. State, number 65193. Ms. Wong, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Good afternoon. My name is Karen Wong. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant Michael Schofield, and at this time I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Your Honor, Mr. Schofield was wrongly convicted of first-degree child kidnapping for taking his son to the store. There are a number of reasons that that kidnapping conviction should be reversed, but today I want to focus on two of those. So the first reason is that the first-degree child kidnapping statute shouldn't be applied to parents at all. And the second reason is that the failure to give the Mendoza instruction for child abuse and kidnapping was plain error under Mendoza and Garcia, and it should be reversed. This case essentially is one of custodial interference, so a dispute between a parent and a guardian over who had the right to tell the child whether or not to go to the store. Whatever the answer to that question is as a civil matter, the criminal statutes are quite clear what should happen. NRS 200.359 addresses the situation of when a parent with no right of custody removes a child from the from his guardian. And if you're interested, that is found at on the opening brief at Roman numeral XI-11. But that's exactly the situation we have here. A parent with no right of custody, and he's charged with removing the child from his guardian. In this situation, NRS 200.359 applies, not NRS 200.310. NRS 200.359, the custodial interference statute, it sets forth two alternatives for convicting a child under that statute. The first is removal of a child from his guardian is a Category D felony if it's in violation of an order, decree, or judgment of any court. But if there's no order, judgment, or decree that says when physical custody is to be exercised or visitation, then the statute's only violated when the parent removes the child from the jurisdiction, removes the child out of state. So it defies common sense to say that the legislature created these specific requirements in NRS 200.359 to convict a parent of custodial interference, but then to say, well, the prosecutor has discretion if these requirements aren't met, if the child's not brought out of state, or if there's no order specifying visitation, the prosecutor can just flip to prosecuting the case as a first-degree child kidnapping case, a Class A felony with a potential life sentence. If we were to follow the state's position and allow first-degree child kidnapping, as distinguished from general first-degree kidnapping, to apply to parents, then every minor custodial dispute could carry a possible life sentence. And I think that it's pretty clear that that's not what the legislature intended.
Counsel, you have asked us to ignore 310 when it comes to a parent and child. Would you feel the same way if the parent and child relationship was not as in this case where there was visitation, but instead where the child was, let's say, 10 or 12, but had never had any contact with a parent, mother or father, and that parent comes and removes the child? You still think that's not kidnapping?
I think certainly it's a much harder case. And but I don't believe that the legislature intended for that to be kidnapping, where the only standard is this take with intent to keep. It's a very low standard. And so if the child was taken, well, if you buy my argument to permanently deprive him from his guardians or to use him for some illegal purpose, then that would still be first-degree kidnapping. But I think that the legislature, by specifying parent with no custody, they're clearly saying parents fall under custodial violations.
All parents.
All parents with no custody fall under 200.359. And I think it's important to recognize that I'm distinguishing that child kidnapping provision of 200.310 from the general first-degree kidnapping or even general second-degree kidnapping provisions that are still there and that are still applicable to parents, such as in Hernandez or in Dada, where there was attempted murder of the child or actual murder of the child and murder of the child's parent, the intent or the plan to take the child out of state. I think those are all valid reasons for first or second degree kidnapping. But under the lower standard of the child kidnapping provisions, then I think you have to look at 200.359. I think that's especially clear when you look at the statute in 310, because it says that the intent has to be to keep the child from parents, guardians, or custodians. Now, it does say or custodians, not and custodians, so I acknowledge that that's a weakness, but I think if you read it in context and if you try to understand the whole of it, that, I mean, the only logical conclusion is that you're removing the child from all of these people, from all of these people who have an interest in the child's welfare. I also want to address the district court's failure to give the Mendoza instruction. I think while the distinction between NRS 200.310 and 359 is a little bit, my argument is a little bit of common sense, I think on the Mendoza instruction, the failure to give that was a violation of the clear binding precedent of this court. A dual conviction for kidnapping and an associated offense can only stand if the kidnapping was not incidental to the associated offense. The state and the district court both knew about this rule, as that was included in the jury instruction number 12, which related to kidnapping and battery constituting domestic violence. And the rationale for that rule is given in Wright, where this court explained that the kidnapping statute is broad in its sweep, and that it would be unreasonable to believe that the legislature intended to have a dual conviction for robbery and kidnapping. And I think the same rationale applies here. It's unreasonable to think that the legislature intended double punishment of child abuse and kidnapping for taking your son from the door of the house to the driveway, essentially, to the car in the driveway. Because the jury was never given this Mendoza instruction, it never had the opportunity to decide, to make a factual determination of when the child abuse ended and when the kidnapping started. In fact, since a similar instruction was given on the battery charge, the jury probably assumed that the child abuse and kidnapping could be exactly the same act. The failure to give the appropriate instruction relieved the state of its burden to prove that the kidnapping was not incidental beyond a reasonable doubt. And for that reason, the kidnapping conviction should be reversed. Unless the court has further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. So.
Good afternoon. I hope it's not inappropriate for me to say this is thrilling. This is my first time appearing in front of this court, and I am both honored and terrified. With the court's permission, my name is Maria Lavelle, and I am representing the respondent, the state of Nevada, for the people of Nevada. I think, with your permission, I will address, I will respond in the order that the appellant raised the issues. The first, the argument that a biological parent should not be charged under 200.310, but rather under 200.359. And obviously it's the state's position, as it was this court's position in Hernandez, that that is not the case. Clearly, had that been the legislative intent, specifically since there is a statute that counsel for the appellant, and I will also refer to as a custodial interference statute, that being 200.359, the legislature was aware that that existed, and so if they wanted to limit criminal charges specific to that statute when it involved parents, whether they had custodial rights or otherwise, they certainly would have made that clear in 200.310. It's the state's position that just as a non-related individual can be charged under 200.359 for custodial interference, a biological or custodial parent can be charged under 200.310. And it is up to the state to determine which statute to charge under. I think it's really important, Justices, that I just give you a really brief synopsis of the facts as it pertains to the kidnapping. Obviously, when the appellant wrote the brief, it's somewhat sanitized. And when we responded to it or replied to it, it's also somewhat sanitized. I did not write the response or the reply. I was the trial attorney. And I will share with you that this wasn't a situation where a father just was merely taking his child to the store. It may have started out that way, but when the child refused to go and the appellant's mother, who is the legal guardian of the child, who was abandoned by his father when he was a toddler, declined to allow him to go because she felt that he looked impaired. When the child told the father he would not go, the appellant threatened to knock his teeth out. He then proceeded to chase the child around the home, inside the home. The grandfather, who is the legal guardian of the child and had been since basically birth, attempted to stop the father from doing so. The father put, the appellant put the child in a chokehold. We charged battery, domestic violence, strangulation. The defendant or the appellant testified and indicated he put him in a chokehold. He did not strangle him. Regardless, there was injuries that supported that the child had been choked. There was residual effects of having been choked. We had a doctor testify that everything that was described indicated strangulation. However, the jury did not find the appellant guilty of strangulation. But having said that, the grandfather said to the appellant while he was choking his child, "You need to stop, you're going to kill him." The child was able to break free, and the doctor testified, had the child not been able to break free from his father, he quite possibly could have died because it does not take a lot of pressure to actually kill someone when you're holding him in the way that the grandfather and the child described the child being held. He then proceeds to push the child out the door and drags him outside away from the grandparents. Now, the granddad, I think, is in his 70s. He picks up a wrench in an attempt to intimidate the appellant from taking this child. The mother, grandmother, appellant's mother, who is also the legal guardian, testified at trial that she had given the defendant, the appellant, permission to take the child to the store. However, that was belied by the 911 call where she is heard outside screaming for the police to come, explaining that she does not know why he's being put in the car. She does not know where the appellant plans on taking the child. The appellant is not even supposed to be in the home. There's also a jail call that the jury hears where the appellant's mother, the guardian, grandmother of the young boy, said, "You were not supposed to take him. I told you could not take him." So this was an extremely violent situation.
The appellant's mom?
I'm sorry?
The appellant's mom?
The appellant's mother is the victim's grandmother,
right.
And she and her husband, the appellant's stepfather,
right,
are the guardians.
Got it.
Okay. So this isn't a situation where there's custodial interference. This is not a situation where an individual fails to return a child when his visitation or her visitation is over and decides they don't like the rules. This isn't a situation where an individual who has custody of a child decides to take the child out of state, which violates some sort of court order. This is not a situation where a non-relative, maybe the boyfriend of a biological parent, decides to hide the child from the other parent at the request of the biological parent. These are the sorts of situations where the state would normally charge with custodial interference. This is clearly a violent situation where the jury likely never believed, that the appellant was taking this child to the store at that point. Because between "I'm taking you to the store" to putting this kid in the car, all of that violence had occurred. And again, the mother of the appellant said to 911, "I don't know why he's put him in the car." So the jury's hearing all of this. So the state would submit to your honors, you have already analyzed this in Hernandez. And although in Hernandez the appellant was charged under the first part of 200.310, where a child could be involved as well. I know that for the purposes of argument, counsel has referred to 200.310, the section that the state used as the child kidnapping portion of 200.310. However, a child certainly could be kidnapped for any of the enumerated reasons in the first portion of 310 as well. But this is not a situation where, I apologize, Justices, I think I lost my train of thought. But similar to the Hernandez decision, your analysis would be the same, regardless of whether or not the biological parent is charged under the first part of this, of 200.310, as it was in Hernandez and also in, I believe, Dahad, or the second part, which was referred to as the child kidnapping section. Your analysis is exactly the same. The fact that there are two distinct NRSs that the facts of this particular case could allow for the state to charge the appellant does not violate due process or make it unconstitutional. And it is up to the state to determine through their discretion which to charge with. And the state chose to charge with 200.310. Based on...
Well, assuming for the moment that and you're using your time on this issue, but I'd like to move on to another
thank
one.
Thank you, Justice.
Assuming
I
for the... No, it's fine.
Okay.
I had a question about what I perceive to be an issue that appellant has raised that may have some merit. The plain language of the kidnapping statute indicates to me, at least, through the use of the word keep, some level of permanent deprivation of the child by the parent from the custodian. And I wonder, based on that, first, what is your view of that interpretation? And then secondly, do the facts in this case marry up with that?
Well, I guess I would answer it this way. It would seem to me, Justice, that had the legislature intended that permanency or that keep equate to permanency, they would have indicated that.
What's the definition of keep? Doesn't it necessarily involve some level of permanent deprivation?
Well, that's obviously a fair question, especially since it's coming from you. But the reality is, I
it's
could
a
ask
fair
you,
question for I, all of us to try to assess.
Well, I could ask you, would you keep this for me until I come and get it? And so I don't know that you can quantify how long keep is, but you need to be cognizant. Or excuse me, I just want to point out that he wasn't charged with just keeping; it was keeping, imprisoning, or confining the child from the guardians. And it's important to note also that it is the legal guardian. So the fact that he is the biological father of this child has absolutely no...
Well, for purposes of my question, I'm assuming that the state could charge this crime. I'm assuming that the fact that he's a parent and the fact that they are guardians doesn't change the analysis. I'm focused primarily on the verbs that describe the activity. So the extent to which the parent keeps them, is that permanent? And frankly, does that approach similarly define the scope of confinement or imprisonment?
Well, you know...
I mean, here we have... Let me ask you this hypothetical.
Okay.
If I, in this same context, Mr. Schofield committed first-degree kidnapping in the first part of his encounter with the child, before the choking. They're outside. The child says no. He chases him around the house. Is that an act that fits within the scope of first-degree kidnapping?
The actual chasing around the house, I would argue that it does not, because he has not taken possession of that child at that point. I think that it's that first of all...
Well, what if he grabbed him by the collar after the child said no and says, you're going with me to the store?
Well,
would that constitute first-degree kidnapping? That act?
I would argue at that point...
grabs him by the collar. Seen a lot of parents do it.
Sure.
Not necessarily proper behavior, but nevertheless, grab the kid by the collar and haul him off to the vehicle and headed to the store. Is that first-degree kidnapping under the statute?
If, in fact...
Certainly looks like a confinement.
Right. This is what I would say.
I don't know if it's an imprisonment.
Well,
and since they're only going to the store, it doesn't sound very permanent.
Right, right.
What's your view of those? Because one of the concerns I think this court should evaluate in interpreting this statute is how far-reaching is this statute in covering some of these acts?
Well, I think what's important, Your Honor, is that the fact that we're using taking him to the store is not what played out in trial. That was a suggestion prior to all of the craziness. So I think that it's important that...
I'm trying to understand the limitations on a criminal statute
right. That
has a life imprisonment. And so how do I distinguish the hypothetical I gave you, which is the first portion of this, where the kid says no to the dad, and dad grabs him by the collar and they head to the car under the presumption that the dad's explanation is they're going to go to the store. How do I distinguish that from him grabbing the kid, taking him after all these other encounters, taking him to the vehicle? He never gets very far, but in any event, he goes there. So how do we avoid the implication of a first-degree kidnapping charge in the first instance versus one in the second?
I hate to say this because it may sound flip, but I think you know it when you see it. And in this particular case, there was so much violence, when the grandmother was on the phone telling 911, he's putting him in the car. I do not know why he's putting him in the car. She indicated that he also pushed the grandfather down. Now, the grandfather and the defendant both, the grandfather said he didn't remember being pushed down, and his wife said, you know, I never said that. But she clearly said it on the 911 tape and couldn't explain why. So this isn't one of those instances. And I would say, Judge, and I can't speak for Justice, I can't speak for my office, but certainly if he's taking the kid to the store and he has the grandparents are allowing that sort of thing, even if the child doesn't want to go, I'm going to say it's not kidnapping because he's not taking him for the purpose of keeping him from the legal guardians. But in this particular case, he absolutely was. And the fact that he's the biological father, I guess I would say, if in fact this was a stranger, not the biological father, doing exactly the same thing, pulling this kid away from the guardians, throwing him into a car, but for the fact that there were two off-duty detectives that were married and living down the street, hearing the family screaming, he's taking them, help us, who knows how long, who knows whether he intended to take him permanently. But I would say that it would seem that if the legislative intent was permanency, they would have indicated that. I have 28 seconds, so if I can address, if you're interested, if I can address the Mendoza instruction. Mendoza is required when detention and or movement is inherent in the companion charge, which is why this court deemed it necessary for robberies, which is why the state gave it for battery, domestic violence, strangulation, because it's inherent in strangulation. It's not inherent in child abuse, endangerment, and neglect. And because it's not inherent in child abuse, endangerment, and neglect, may I just continue the sentence?
Of course.
Finish
your thought.
Thank you. Even though the facts suggested seizure and aspiration or aspartation, child abuse in itself is not inherently, does not require either of those. And in a great many child abuse, neglect, and endangerment, there is no seizure and there is no movement. So the state is not required to provide that instruction. And so because this was not preserved at trial, it would be evaluated under plain error. And certainly because since this court has held in a number of different cases that in order for Mendoza to be required, the restraint of the victim has to be inherent or the movement with the primary offense, it wouldn't dawn on the judge to sua sponte ask for that instruction. And the state analyzed it and, in fact, gave it for the strangulation because that is inherent, the restraint at least, and it's not inherent in the child abuse, so it was not required. If your honors believed differently, I would argue that taking the child from the home, from the grandparents, taking him in a car with the intent to drive off with him, absolutely increased the risk of harm. And so I would ask, obviously, that count remain. Thank you for letting me go a little over.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lavelle. Ms. Sloan?
The state has gone over the facts of the case and indicated that the record's been sanitized, as it always is to some extent on appeal. But I think it's important to separate out, you know, yes, there was violence here, and that's why the defendant admits that he committed child abuse. But that child abuse charge was separate from the kidnapping in terms of the element. Now, it wasn't separate in terms of the course of conduct. I think that they were exactly the same, but that's the Mendoza issue. But, I mean, when Norman says, you need to stop, you're going to kill him, he was saying, you need to stop this child abuse. He wasn't saying, you can't take this boy to the store. There was never, I mean, in the course of their relationship, the defendant would take his son to the park, to his own apartment, and there's never been any indication that that was ever a problem. In this situation, it was a problem because of the child abuse. And that's why, the violence, it doesn't matter to the kidnapping charge. The counsel also addressed Hernandez and said that 200.310 should apply.
Before you get into the Hernandez discussion,
okay.
My understanding, and I may be wrong about this, the defense did not offer any other instruction other than instruction 10 with respect to the kidnapping charge. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it agreed that that instruction accurately stated the elements of kidnapping.
The defense did contest jury instruction number 10, but did not offer a proposed instruction that would have called out the issue of intent to keep or whether the statute applied. That is correct.
So if the court were to agree with your view that the statute should require some level of permanency, what would the jury instruction be in future cases?
I think that you could include definitions at the end. To keep means to keep from the parents, guardians, or legal custodians permanently. I think that would be a simple way to address it.
What about counsel's argument that, in addition here, there was some level of imprisonment in the vehicle, there was some level of confinement in the vehicle? I guess your argument was that neither of those acts were done for the purpose of permanently depriving the child from the guardian.
I would argue that, and I also think that was not really what was tried to the jury. That was not a decision that the jury made. And so if now we were to say, well, we think the jury would have said that that was confinement or imprisonment, that's not what was argued in closing argument.
The state's closing argument on child kidnapping?
The state said,
on first degree kidnapping.
Argument at one point, kidnapping as it's charged in this information and specific to this count is his taking this kid away without the permission of his lawful guardians. There's nothing in the statute that says he has to permanently keep the child or have the intention of permanently keeping the child. The state also says before that, so how do you know that he was intending to take that child from Norman and Patricia? Well, he said it himself, I'm taking him. You will go with me because I'm your father. And he says and acts that he's taking Michael Joshua from the home, and it goes on. And so at most...
Did the defense in its argument, I'm going to read these arguments again, but did the defense in its argument argue an absence of permanency as a basis for not finding guilt on this charge?
Your Honor, the defendant, who was at that time representing himself pro se, did argue that I was taking him to the store, this is not kidnapping. But he did not specifically say
permanency. But anyway, the thrust of his argument was this was a temporary taking.
That's right.
You were going to make a comment about Hernandez.
Right. And the state has argued that Hernandez should apply to this case, and I think that that's clearly distinguishable. If there was violence or any other improper motive that rose to the level of qualifying the act for conviction under the first part of the first-degree kidnapping statute, then fine, that's Hernandez. Well, Hernandez actually is second-degree kidnapping, even though he had killed his mother, killed the child's mother. But, I mean, I think the lower standards in the child kidnapping statute, plus the language that it has to be from the parents, guardians, or lawful custodians, exempts that second half, the child kidnapping provisions, from application to parents. And I also think that even if there is some ambiguity there, then the court should apply the rule of lenity. If there are two reasonable interpretations of the statute, then in this case, those child kidnapping provisions should not apply to the defendant. And lastly, I think it's important to focus on what did the legislature intend? When we step back, if the legislature were here today and we were to say, hey, what about this situation? Do you think that the prosecutor should have full discretion to prosecute under 310 or 359? I think that it's clear from the layout of the statute that they would say, no, we passed NRS 200.359 in 1975, knowing that there was a general kidnapping statute, because we wanted to be specific about parents who do things in violation of custody orders. And so I think because that was enacted by the legislature with all those specific requirements, that you can't say that they intended that, well, if those requirements aren't met, we can go to the general kidnapping statute. Your Honor also addressed the intent to keep argument and the hypo, and obviously my response would be that the keeping has to be permanent, and so whether he grabs him by the collar or throws him in the car violently, neither of those is a keeping in violation of the statute. And so in conclusion, I just want to emphasize that first-degree child kidnapping, In the emotional and contentious area of custody disputes, we don't want to put that life sentence as an option there as a nuclear weapon for the parties. And that's all the time I have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. Ms. Wong, Ms. Lavelle, you both distinguished yourself very much today. And we thank you very much for your excellent arguments and briefing in the case, and it will stand submitted.